Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Europeans worked out an answer to the Irish debt crisis over the weekend, including who's going to have to pay next time there's a country in trouble. Notice they didn't say if there's another country in trouble. We'll explain. Also, the United Nations goes to Cancun to talk climate change. And so do we. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Toyota. Toyota is sharing technology and ideas for a better world. Learn more at toyota.com/ideas for good. And by Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms committed to helping business owners and in-house counsel find local, pre-qualified legal counsel for over 20 years. Meritas.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 29th of November. Good to have you with us. No sooner was the ink dry on the Irish bailout plan yesterday, $110 billion plus or minus to save the Irish banks, than attention turned to Portugal, widely regarded as the next weakest link in the wider European economy. Already, bond markets are making it difficult for Lisbon to borrow, which brings us to the other key piece of business decided in Europe over the weekend, eventually making private investors bear some of the costs of crisis. Christopher Wirth has more now from London.
Up until now, investors holding sovereign bonds and bank debt have been completely protected from any losses when things go sour. That was true when Greece was rescued earlier this year, and now investors in Ireland will be sheltered from the storm. But Brian Lucey, a finance professor at Trinity College Dublin, says that will soon change.
The results of this are going to be down the line a restructuring of debt.
In other words, under the EU's new plan, bondholders could potentially take a hit starting in 2013. That's when the fund set up earlier this year and used to prop up Ireland's finances expires. But Simon Tilford of the Center for European Reform says that threat of punishing private investors is what got Ireland into trouble in the first place.
By explicitly acknowledging that there could be restructuring and default, they have made that eventuality much, much more likely.
He says putting bondholders on the line will drive up what are already high borrowing costs for what analysts see as the next dominoes to fall, Portugal, Spain, and Italy.
All this announcement has done has made investors even more wary of lending to them. The problem with this now is that by pushing up further the cost of borrowing for these countries, they leave them with no option but to enforce even greater austerity.
And Tilford says that could hinder the kind of economic growth that would help struggling Eurozone countries repay their debts in the first place. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
The president of the United States makes $400,000 a year. The baseline congressional salary is $174,000 per annum. The real federal pay story of the day, though, is the 2 million civilian federal workers who aren't going to be getting raises the next 2 years. President Obama called for a government pay freeze today as part of a way to cut deficits. Congress does still have to approve, but assuming they do, how much of a budget difference is this really going to make? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
The Obama administration says the two-year pay freeze will save more than $60 billion over 10 years. Chump change, says Steve Ellis of Taxpayers for Common Sense.
Right now, the federal government needs to be searching the couch cushions for any spare change. And the billions that would be saved by the pay freeze are certainly just spare change. But at this point, we can take anything we can get.
Ellis says the president still needs to tackle the things that contribute most to our trillion-dollar-plus deficit, Medicare, Social Security, and the Pentagon. President Obama's bipartisan deficit-cutting commission is scheduled to make recommendations this week, but it's currently deadlocked. Diane Lim Rogers is chief economist at the Concord Coalition. She says President Obama is taking the first shot in the deficit battles to come, but
it's not going to help him avoid the need to address the tough choices about programs that benefit all Americans.
Alice Rivlin was President Clinton's budget director, and she's a member of the Deficit Commission. She says President Obama knows the pay freeze is just an appetizer on the deficit-cutting menu.
The only question is, do we wait or do we act like grown-ups and pull up our socks and do it right now?
Washington isn't known for grown-up behavior, but Rivlin says if we don't cut the deficit a lot, we'll be in a deep debt crisis that forces us to grow up fast. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The one thing we really didn't want to do today, even while realizing that we kind of had to do something about holiday shopping, was your average run-of-the-mill retailers made so many millions of dollars on Black Friday story. So we called a guy who got up early Friday morning, not because he wanted to, but because he had to. Marshall Cohn is the chief retail analyst at the NPD Group, a guy for whom Black Friday is more than just a catchy phrase. Marshall, good to talk to you.
Pleasure to be here.
So I guess the very nature of your job demands that you are out there among them on Friday morning real early.
I get the wonderful opportunity to interview consumers while they're online, while they're in stores, and while they're coming out of stores. And it starts from midnight and goes all the way through till 16 hours straight later.
What kinds of questions do you ask?
Basically, what I try to do is understand why these consumers are getting in these lines, what they plan on getting, and then once they're in, are they finding what they're looking for? I like to ask the questions that retailers don't get to know the answers to, which is, why didn't they buy? And then, of course, finding out, did they buy and spend more than last year, less than last year? Are they satisfied with what they got? And how many people did they buy on their gift list for?
Yeah, so tell me a story. What'd you find out there?
You know, traditionally at holiday time, 24 to 26% of all holiday purchases are people buying things for themselves. And in the last 2 years, that disappeared. This year, it came back. Almost 37% of people who shopped during the Black Friday weekend were picking up some nifty gifties and some great deals for themselves. And that's a good sign because that means that the pent-up demand has finally kicked in with consumers starting to spend the money again.
Do you ever have people say, no, get away from me. I have to, you know, wrestle somebody for this television set?
The most thing I get asked for is to help them load it in or help them carry it out. That's the first thing I always get. And once in a while, people sit there and ask me to go down that aisle and help them look for the item because they can't find it. But there are occasions when people literally just say, hey, I am absolutely too busy. Don't bother me. Go away.
Is this the way that we've been getting this data since you've been in the industry?
You know, having been in retail for over 30 years, I can tell you that trying to collect the information as quickly as possible and learning how to utilize it has been around for a while, but it certainly changes from year to year, and we try to get it more defined and more understood. Most researchers don't really go into the field much. They may visit a store here and there, but really to get the pulse of the weekend, you've got to spend it from start to finish and compare apples to apples. The same store at the same opening hours compared to the ones from last year.
Now, did you get any personal shopping done while you were out?
Actually, not at all. it's too crazy. I'm not going to waste 40 minutes standing online to check out. If I did find a great deal, I would ask somebody to hold it and come back and buy when there was no line.
Other than shoe leather, though, are we going to use technology and all that stuff to get better figures on retail analysis?
You know, it used to be that retailers would wait till the weekend was over and get the computer reports and take a look. Now it's about getting right there on the spot information direct from the consumer as well as from the point of sale. And going down the road, we're starting to use mobile devices to be able to capture what's going on within the store, where consumers are searching, what are they looking for. Also, there's technology that's coming down the road that's going to be able to capture all kinds of social media usage and all kinds of emails and cell phone calls and monitor all the what they call a buzz, being able to scope it out and understand where the consumer's interests are.
Yeah. Marshall Cohn, chief retail analyst for the NPD Group. Marshall, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Three little words described Wall Street today. No, it wasn't Cyber Monday shoppers. Try European debt crisis instead. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So here's a problem you don't run across too often. A business having too much money. That was the unusual message that went out just before Thanksgiving from a financial institution that serves members of the two biggest actors' unions. That would be the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists and the Screen Actors Guild. The AFTRA-SAG Federal Credit Union sent a letter to people with large accounts suggesting that they consider putting their money somewhere else because the credit union says it is, and this is a quote, flooded with cash. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains how that might add up to trouble.
The credit union's website says it manages more than $200 million in assets, and like most credit unions, it pays a little more interest on those deposits than banks do. Lately, though, generating those returns hasn't been easy, especially since the money earned lending to customers has largely dried up. Earlier this year, a credit union in Nevada actually started paying its depositors a bonus for withdrawing funds. Bill Hample is chief economist for the Credit Union National Association.
In normal times, what they would do is they would just take the funds that were not being loaned out and invest them. But right now, interest rates on short-term investments are essentially very close to zero, so there's not much they can do with the money.
Hample concedes urging members to withdraw money is unusual. The normal approach is lowering interest rates to discourage customers from depositing too much. Industry consultant Bert Ely thinks the Take Your Money Elsewhere request was made to stay competitive against rival banks.
They apparently have aimed this letter at certain depositors who have high balances. And so by encouraging some people to pull their money out, that would enable the credit union to continue to pay higher interest rates than banks pay.
The credit unions complain federal rules allow banks to go after business customers, but limit that option to a small slice of a credit union's assets. Again, the industry's Bill Hample.
We feel that we should be allowed to have something more than 12% of our assets in business loans, and the bankers would prefer that we stay at this limit, even if some of them are unable to meet all of their small business loan demands.
Hample says tighter lending standards mean fewer consumers qualify for loans, and those who do are reluctant to borrow in these lean times. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
United Nations climate negotiators are at it again, this time in Cancun, Mexico, for a two-week conference on how to stop global warming. I don't know, maybe they're hoping nicer weather will be more conducive to agreement than a Danish winter was. Last December's summit in Copenhagen began with great fanfare, ended mostly with a thud. No binding agreements on carbon emissions came out of it. Marketplace's Scott Tong has drawn the short straw. He gets 2 weeks in the sun in Cancun trying to figure out where big-time climate negotiations might be headed. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Kai.
So how is the global climate change community going to pick up those pieces from Copenhagen and move on?
Well, the tone here among the faithful is keep hope alive a year after Copenhagen. I mean, the first few days of this conference are theater, and there are all these signs that they really believe that we're onto something. The trash cans here have six subsections for organic, inorganic, glass, paper, plastic. The conference buses run on biodiesel fuel. And there's even this brand new, apparently cosmetic wind turbine outside the main exhibit hall. And so the point is, as one delegate told me, confidence building. He says countries' trusts in one another bottomed out last winter and this spring, and it's slowly been creeping back. And the hope here is to end this two-week conference with enough progress to sign some kind of a document in several areas by the end.
So here's the show me the money question, Scott. What has been done since Copenhagen?
Well, each country signed the voluntary Copenhagen Accord. And in that, there was agreement on the big goal, and that is to keep global temperature rise under 2 degrees Celsius. Some 80 countries pledged unilateral carbon dioxide emissions targets, and the rich countries agreed to give $30 billion to the developing countries. So how do we check that all that is happening? I mean, the UN doesn't have climate police, so that's what's happening here. They're trying to find ways to measure progress, verify the money is flowing, that the emissions are going down in all these different countries. It's all really technical. But the optimists say if it builds enough momentum, then we could have a big binding deal next year in South Africa where there's some global carbon cap.
Yeah, but let me ask you this, though, Scott. Is just measuring things real progress?
Well, it is measuring how much progress countries are making, but the issue is scale, is the how much. Now the world has a budding solar industry and wind power, electric cars, but multiplying that up at a big scale takes a lot of money, and most of that comes from the private sector. The idea is for a government to put in, say, $1, and the private sector matches it, chips in $4 or even $10. And to get there, the regulators have to make clear to investors that we are building the plumbing, the infrastructure of a low-carbon future, that it's inevitable. I spoke to energy expert Dan Kamen at the World Bank about this, and here's how he put it.
Many in the private sector rightly say, well, my job isn't to make policy. My job is to respond to policy. I am willing to operate in a clean energy economy, but governments have to set those rules.
Well, very quickly on the way out here, Scott, let me ask you about governments, specifically the United States. We don't have a climate bill. Prospects are dim. What is the American role down there in Cancun?
The question of, is the U.S. serious? That shadow looms over all this. You know, many people have told me that the U.S., as the biggest emitter per person, has to show that it is serious. It made some promises in 97, didn't happen. It promised legislation, didn't happen. Now it pledged cuts at Copenhagen. U.S. negotiators say, yes, there are new vehicle mileage standards, new regulations on power plants. But if the U.S. isn't perceived as delivering, that will make it hard for everything. It risks the whole U.N. process being deemed irrelevant.
Marketplace's Scott Tong on the line from Cancun and the U.N. Global Climate Change Summit going on there. He'll be there all 2 weeks that the summit's going on. Scott, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Kai.
Coming up, humorist Amy Sedaris on the rise of crafting.
A lot of people, they're spending a lot more time at home, and they're getting back to an old hobby just so, you know, they're not so depressed listening to the news.
But first, let's do the numbers. On Wall Street today, the European debt crisis overshadowed strong retail sales. The Dow Industrials lost 39 points, about a third of 1%, finished at 11,052. The NASDAQ ditched 9 points, also about a third percent, 2525. The S&P 500 shed a point, about a tenth of 1%, closed at 1187. The National Retail Federation said stores and retail websites saw 8% more business this Thanksgiving weekend than last year. Retail stocks were kind of mixed today. Shares of Macy's dropped 2 2/10% today, and Taylor unraveled 1 1/3%. On the plus side, Amazon.com booked gains of 1 3/10% today. JCPenney polished up a 2/3% gain. Walmart added 2/10%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.82%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt, it's more car than electric. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Tuesday. The President's Deficit Commission holds a meeting on the country's long-term fiscal challenges. The Coalition to Strengthen Social Security is urging people to call their senators and protest cuts to Social Security as part of a national call-in to Congress Day. And on this day in 1998, Exxon and Mobil Oil Company signed a $73.7 billion merger agreement to become Exxon Mobil. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The timing on this next one was less than ideal, coming as it did on the day when President Obama called for that federal pay freeze. But top White House science advisors said today we need to spend more money on energy research. Three times what we're spending now, in fact. Bump it up to $16 billion a year. Energy research is a pretty broad phrase, though. So how do you decide what technology to fund? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports it can be tough to know what to bet on.
Charles Vest has a few words for you on the economic benefits of federally funded science.
The computer, the laser, the internet, the fundamentals of the global positioning system, deployment of the World Wide Web, most of modern medicine. The genetic
Vest heads
revolution.
The National Academy of Engineering.
There's not a job in the United States today that it does not directly depend on one or more of those things that came out of these research investments.
A relatively small investment, too, less than 4% of all federal spending. But that spending can change the world. A National Science Foundation grant for digital library research helped create Google, says Christopher Hill. He teaches public policy and technology at George Mason University.
Google has changed the way all of us do business in many aspects of our lives. The question is, could we have figured out in advance that that little NSF grant was going to result in the creation of a multi-hundred-billion-dollar corporation? My guess is no.
That's why Charles Vest argues the government should spread its science bets widely.
We don't know exactly what will be next. Will it be synthetic biology that drives this? Will it be nanotechnology? We don't know, so we have to invest in a pretty broad portfolio.
Daniel Sarowitz is co-director of the Consortium for Science Policy and Outcomes at Arizona State University. He says when every federal dollar counts and we need a quick economic payoff, we should shore up basic science that improves on existing technologies.
I certainly think energy is the most obvious example. We have, for many reasons, an urgent need to get off our dependence on hydrocarbons. There's lots of alternative energy possibilities out there.
So that might mean research that helps make solar power cheaper than coal or electric car batteries smaller. And Sarowitz thinks the Department of Defense might be the smartest place to do it.
Historically, that's been what has driven new frontiers of technology. DOD first uses them. They're expensive, but they test them out, help get the kinks out of them.
Then private companies take it from there. But that debate may have to wait. Most scientists are just worried about protecting R&D from an incoming Congress intent on slashing all federal spending. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
For all its efficiencies, for never having to leave home, for not paying sales tax, depending on where you are, shopping online for the holidays is so impersonal. There's just nothing about it that says, hey, I took the time to really put some effort into getting you this present. Which brings us to crafting, the making of things at home, and also to writer and comedian Amy Sedaris. Just as her show Strangers with Candy parodied those after-school specials we know, her new book skewers the wholesomeness of the DIY crafting culture, parody being the key word here. Amy Sedaris, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Simple Times, Crafts for Poor People is the title of this book. Were you a crafter when you were a kid?
Yes, I was. Girl Scouts, Junior Achievements, and my family, we were crafters. We would turn the basement into like a Santa's workshop and make crafts for the holidays.
We're in the middle of this recession,
we
just
are.
Getting out of it. Economy's terrible. Do you think more people are crafting?
Well, that's what I hear. A lot of people, they're spending a lot more time at home, and they're getting back to an old hobby just so, you know, they're not so depressed listening to the news.
Well, let me ask you this, though. What's the difference between a hobby and a craft?
I think of a hobby like maybe making beer and wine.
All right.
But I have a chapter on sausage making in the book, and I put that in a craft book.
But for some, that's a hobby.
Yes, I think that would be a hobby, making sausages, but I use it as a craft in here and knitted some sausages.
So the line is blurry then?
It's still very blurry.
Who is the crafter these days? It's easy to say Martha Stewart and all that. But.
Well, ugly people. I always say ugly people are crafting, pretty people are having sex. People, I guess, who just want their mind to just wander. They just want to do stuff with their hands so they can just think about whatever. A lot of lonely people. You know, a lot of crafters, you know, they're shut-ins.
Yeah, you know where to send those cards and letters, folks. letters@marketplace.org. When you are doing crafts, when you're sitting around your apartment making, you know, drawer pulls out of string, what are you thinking about? I mean, is your mind just going blank?
I like to just make things. If I have the TV on, I'm not just going to sit there. I want to do something with my hands. You know, I've always got a project. Or I get a small group of people over and I say, let's make these things today.
Yeah. What if you want to craft and you're just not good at it? You're just not good with your hands.
You can get a kit and it'll help you. It'll teach you. And then, like, I use those potholder kits from Klutz, and I'm really good with that. It takes me 20 minutes to make one potholder. And I'm so happy when I accomplish it. And I sell them on the road. I always have to have something to sell if there's an audience.
And so what does an Amy Sedaris potholder go for?
Well, this time I was selling them for $10 a piece.
All right. That's a little steep.
Yeah, I don't know. I wanted to make it expensive. And, you know, a lot of time crafts are expensive because of the time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because of the time. And then it's just crap. A lot of it's crap nobody wants, and you certainly don't need it. You know, that's why I like crafts that are, like, you need them, like a pincushion.
All right, well, speaking of stuff nobody wants or needs, we're actually going to do a little crafting here, okay?
Okay.
So we are going to make, what are we going to make?
A rusty nail wind chime. I have a chapter in my book for people who have a some sort of disability, crippling long fingernails, chronic back pain, poor eyesight.
Right.
And so this is a craft I'm recommending for people who are bipolar. So when they're
because
what they can do is when they're, you know, low,
all
they have to do is take a fistful of nails and throw them in their backyard. And then on an upswing, you can go out to the backyard, and by then all the nails are going to be rusty. So you gather those rusty nails, and you're going to take some embroidery string, colorful embroidery string, and you're going to take the flat part of the nail, and you're going to wrap the string around it, and you're going to attach it to a hanger that you have shaped into a spiral shape.
All right, so we're going to try it here. We have a bag, not of rusty nails, but galvanized, in this case, screws. You take one, I'll take one.
Okay.
And what are we doing? Just tying
colorful string.
We have red, you've got yellow.
I've got yellow, you've got green,
handily pre-cut.
Gray.
So what are we doing? We're just tying the screws
on. You got it.
All right, so here's my screw.
Oh my God, you did it so fast. Nice job.
Well, you know, I'm no dope. Wait, listen, it's a wind chime.
I think that sounds nice. All I think you should have that on your radio show all the time.
Maybe we'll just, instead of the gong that we do at the top of the show, we'll just do these. I don't know if it has as much oomph, though. Amy Sedaris, her new book is called Simple Times, Crafts for Poor People. We've got her 10 commandments for crafting and photos of this galvanized screw wind chime. It's all on our website, marketplace.org. It's on our new book blog called The Big Book. Amy Sedaris, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you very much. Enjoy your chime.
I will.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. By Constant Contact, helping small businesses and nonprofits make sense of social media. You can learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a helpful tip as you get those holiday packages ready to ship off to relatives. Whatever you do, do not market fragile. The good people at Popular Mechanics did some actual science on this. They packaged up identical bunches of vibration sensors, and they put them in packages, sent them off with the UPS, FedEx, and the Postal Service, and tried to figure out which one was the gentlest. The post office won, but here's the thing. The sensors inside the packages that were marked fragile or this side up show that they got the roughest treatment. So there you go. No fragile. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow lost 39 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ ditched 9 points, also about a third percent. The S&P 500 shed a single point, about a tenth of 1% on that particular index. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, when your business is issuing insurance policies against hurricanes and floods, some things are just a given.
Industry has accepted absolutely that climate change is real.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.